Hello. The summer has come, and I'm delighted so many have stayed on to this point of the Monday evening. Garth Hewitt from the Amos Trust, and particularly pleased to be introducing our guest, Yehuda Shaul. I had the opportunity to interview him in Jerusalem this summer, and the story that I heard on that occasion is one that I thought we have to hear. Christian Aid have good partners with Breaking the Silence, particularly in terms of advocacy, and they have facilitated this as well. And I know Yehuda will tell his story, but sufficient to say we have here a religious, conservative, Jewish Israeli. And I'm not stealing your talk yet, am I, Yehuda? Who served in the army and will tell us why he has broken the silence and what that means. We've had a variety of talks this weekend, and this is a voice that we've not heard and is very important to hear. And just recently I heard a report of a breaking the silence showing, I think, members of the British government or the Foreign Office around in Hebron, and the van was attacked by settlers. So you might be interested to hear that story. Maybe Yehuda will tell us about that. But it's a very important organization. I'm delighted you're here. Yehuda's come down from a Jewish festival up in, I think, Cumbria or somewhere. So it's been a long travel. You probably don't know where you've come from. Not sure where he is either. Will you give him a very warm welcome, Yehuda Shaul?
I'm kind of losing myself here in front of all this equipment and all these people. So thank you all for coming. I hope I'll deliver something that, you know, after this session, you'll know something you didn't know before. As a matter of fact, I have no idea what to talk about. It's like 50 minutes, and I'm trying to think what I can squeeze in. So let you vote. I can speak a bit about my personal story, or I can speak a bit about the group Breaking the Silence. What do you prefer? What?
Yes.
Both? Yes. Personal story. Oh my God, okay, so I have to sit down for the personal story. Yeah, I think I'll feel more comfortable. I haven't done this for years, but... So, I'm 25 years old. I was born in Jerusalem. My parents emigrated from North America. My father's from Canadian Jew. My mother's from New York. Immigrated to Israel. I grew up in an American Orthodox Jewish family. This is where you were mistaken. I'm not a conservative Jew. I'm an Orthodox Jew. Not even an Orthodox, an ultra-Orthodox Jew. I come from what you would call the right side of Israeli politics. Did my high school in the yeshiva in a settlement near Ramallah in the West Bank. Once I graduated high school, I joined the military. I joined the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces. In Israel, we have a draft. Men serve for 3 years, women for 2 years. If you're in good health condition, you'll be sent to be a member in a combat unit. I must say that for me back then, I had no doubt whether to serve or not. The only question I had in front of me is whether I'll get into an elite commando unit or I'll just be a regular combat soldier. You know, whether I'll be an officer or just a regular commander. And because since I finished high school and before I joined the draft, I started crossing political lines of what you would call the Israeli right to the Israeli left. I was a kind of like, you know, central left. I felt, you know, I was what I call today a very abstract lefty or philosophical lefty. I thought it's wrong to occupy people, not to give them rights. If all the idea of a Jewish state is that every nation has a self-determination to, you know, have its own state, so the Palestinians should have for the same reason. But I had really no clue, no idea about what's going on in the territories. And I joined the infantry unit in March 2001, did 4 months of basic training, 2 more months of professional infantry training. Throughout my training, I didn't really reach the territories. And I was always very sure and confident that it's really very good and important that people like me will go to serve in the territories, people who are aware of the political situation, people who care, people who might do it different, people who might, you know, smile at the checkpoint, people who might be able to show a human side behind the uniforms. I was more or less a good soldier, I think. I did what I was supposed to do. I was one of those who had always questions at the end, mainly political questions, but more or less I was a good soldier. And I finished my training, and you finish the training, you become part of the battalion. It's like a very serious step in the forward for a combat soldier. And I joined the battalion, and we were training up in the north of Israel in the Golan Heights. After a few days of training, it was in October 2001, that was when the Israeli minister, Rehavam Zevi, was assassinated. Was assassinated in East Jerusalem, and the IDF decided, basically Israel decided to launch a big operation and to occupy some Palestinian cities in the territories at that time. We were sent to occupy Qalqilya, which is a big Palestinian city in the center of the West Bank. There was a lot of pride in that. First time the IDF is, since the Oslo times in the 90s, first time we're going to occupy a Palestinian city. Our unit was chosen to do that. But I wasn't in the front. I was a young soldier, so I just, you know, spent my time in an ambush with heavy machine guns somewhere inside the bushes outside of the city. Rain, not enough sleep, without hot meals. Feeling miserable. Very fast you become a soldier in the field, and I think what's the most powerful thing about it, being a soldier, is that very fast you're the victim and you're the center of everything, and it's all about your conditions. And things that, you know, very, very simple things that in a daily life you won't even think of, but these are the most important things. And when is last you will take out, you, when last you took off your shoes, and when was the last shower you took? And we were there for a week or two, I don't remember exactly, and that's when I was sent to Hebron, which is a big Palestinian city in the south of the West Bank. I don't know how many of you have been to Hebron. I assume not much. But I'll just say a few words about Hebron. Hebron is a very unique city in the West Bank. It's the only Palestinian city which has an Israeli settlement in the heart of the city. It's the second largest Palestinian city in the West Bank. Around 166,000 Palestinians live in Hebron, and inside a city, 800 settlers live in the center. Of course, the story there is a religious story. We're in a religious festival, so it's quite a good place to mention. The Tomb of the Patriarchs, where Abraham, Jacob, Isaac, forefathers and mothers of both nations, of all nations, most nations are buried there. And my my first assignment in Hebron was not quite important here to the story. I was in a barrack, which was guarding a specific neighborhood or something like that. I was sitting inside what used to be a Palestinian school that closed down. Nothing important we can talk about now. But after 2-3 weeks, the decision was taken that my unit will take over all the city of Hebron. At the first, we were just assisting. A different unit was in charge and the control. And then came the decision that we will replace them. And I was very excited because one of the soldiers who served there in that unit was my friend from high school. And I haven't seen him for a long time, because if you join the military together and you don't have the same weekends off, you can go on for months without seeing each other. And I entered the barrack, and I was very excited to see him. I just, you know, the gate is open. I step in, and the soldiers that we're going to replace is starting for their last briefing before their last mission. In 2-3 hours, we're going to replace them. And the sergeant was standing in the center, briefing the soldiers. One of the soldiers in front of the sergeant was standing with a stick and playing with the stick like this, doing like this in his hand. And I just arrived at the last minute of the briefing and paid attention. The sergeant goes something like, "Hey guys, just make sure you don't abuse too many people. There's a guy you beat up, happened to be is an Israeli Arab. He filed a complaint. His brother's in the military. Now we're in serious shit. Military police is now on our back." And everybody started laughing. And I was like, "What?" But my friend just jumped out of the room and, "Hey, Shmulik, what's up?" Hugging, kissing, very fast, dealing with what soldiers are interested in. You know, how long are the duty the shifts here? How often you get back home? And you kind of slide into Hebron. One of the things that bothered us when we served in Hebron, and that is the settler violence. Hebron settler community, although it's only 800 settlers, it's the most violent settler community around the territories. And Jesse would stand there. My third day, standing in the center of the city in a post, and there was a tent in the city center. There was a tent, and the settlers would pray there and protest, and call the IDF to occupy parts of the Palestinian part of the city. And there were two Palestinian youth walking out of the market of the old city. And while they're just walking out and trying to cross the street, the guys who were busy with the afternoon prayer, mincha, suddenly saw them, stopped their prayer, started running on them, chasing them, starting to attack them and screaming, "Hey, they have a knife, they have a knife, they came to stab someone." And, you know, you're in the third, fourth day in the field, you kind of know who are the good guys, who are the bad guys. The good guys are the Israelis, the bad guys are the Palestinians. Very fast, you do what you have to do, you're here to protect the settlers. You grab the Palestinians, smash them into the wall, turn them around, check. And it takes a minute or two till you realize, no, they have no knife. They didn't try to stab anyone. It was just... And while we're searching them, settlers are beating them up, you know, continuing to punching them. And once we understand that, we turn around, put the Palestinians on the floor and try to stand in between. Now, the problem is, and this is why I'm giving the story, one of the things that really frustrated us was that our orders were that we're not allowed to touch the settlers. Mainly in the territories, in the West Bank, we have two sets of laws imposed by two different executive forces and two different communities. So you would have the Israeli military imposing martial law on Palestinians, and you would have Israeli police imposing Israeli law on settlers. So although by international law, you stand in Hebron, you don't stand in Israel, Israel itself doesn't declare Hebron as part of its state, of its territory. So Israeli law doesn't apply in the place. So according to international law and Israeli law, you're obligated to protect all inhabitants of the city. The orders you receive from your commanders on the briefings every day is that you're not allowed to touch. You have no legal authorization above a settler. That's why we have the police. Now, the police doesn't do its job there, not because they don't want. And this is very important that you understand. Policemen in the field just wait for the day they will get the political support to enforce law. Because their job is to enforce law on settlers, the settlers view them as enemies. So one of the things you will never see inside Hebron is settlers entering a settlement without IDF escort, without us as the military protecting them from the settlers. Because the settlers won't want to attack us because they don't want to break the good relationship between us and them. So it's enough you put a soldier in the crowd, they stop, throw stones and eggs. So it was, you know, it took 3-4 minutes till we understood what was going on. Settlers tried to continue beat up these Palestinian youth, and we went on the radio and called the police. After 20 minutes, the police arrived. All the settlers who attacked them were already in the cars driving away. Nothing really happened. Palestinians were a bit hurt, went back to their neighborhood. Things are gone to normal. And these kind of stories happen too much in Hebron. And I served in a very unique unit, which was most of the people who served with me were lefties. Very high educated, come from very well social economical background, people who come from socialist youth movements in Israel. It's a very unique unit. There's only one battalion like that in all the Israeli military. Nachal. People who come from socialist youth movements, live in socialist communes. If you're obligated to do 3 years, they volunteer for 4.5 years and do social work in poor communities in Israel, and etc. So very fast, it was too much for us, what we saw in Hebron. The straw that broke the camel's back for us was once we were sent out to impose the idea of sterile streets. And I'll explain what I mean. Because we have in Hebron a very weird situation, a wacko situation, 800 people in the heart of 166,000, the Israeli military decided that the best way to protect the settlers is by creating sterile buffer zones between them and the Palestinians. So as close you get to the settlement, the sterilization of the area is higher. There are areas where Palestinians are not allowed to drive cars. There are areas where they're not allowed to open shops. But the high level of sterilization inside the city is areas where pedestrian Palestinians are not allowed to walk. Now, this is not a street in a different city that you're not allowed to walk on. This is a street where you live on, and you're not allowed to walk. So your front door will be wooded shut, and the only way to get in and out will be climb on the roof, take some ladders, jump from one balcony to another, and find a back way to a back street. And we were sent to, to wheel up the doors, and that was kind of something that brought people inside the unit to start a question. What we're doing? Is it right or wrong what we're doing? Is it moral or immoral? Should we refuse to serve here or not? Which is, again, don't take me as an example. All my friends in Breaking the Silence today laugh at me that I didn't serve in the IDF. In Tzahal, I served in the Nachal. These kind of discussions will never happen in different units, in other units. And it came to a point where it was a very interesting thing. We would have discussions with our officers about what we're doing, which sounds like, anyone who knows military life, it sounds like outrageous. But in that unit, again, it's very different. The officers are people who were your guides in a youth movement, from the same youth movement. You know them before. A very, very different relationship, very open relationship. So it went on for a week or two, these discussions, and the military decided after a year we went of service without getting a real break, the military decided to give us a week off. That was in April 2002. Probably most of you don't remember what happened in April 2002. February, March, April, very deadly months inside Israel. Over 120 Israelis were murdered in suicide bombing attacks. Passover 2002 was a suicide bombing attack in the Park Hotel in Netanya. If I'm not mistaken, 26 Israelis were murdered, and that's basically when Israel decided to launch an operation called Defensive Shield Operation, basically meaning reoccupy all the West Bank from the Palestinian Authority and destroy the Palestinian Authority. All the security forces, police, army, intelligence forces, everything to destroy. Kind of that's when the PA, the Palestinian Authority, was announced as an enemy in a way. And we were called up, of course, from our vacation and sent into Ramallah. And basically this is when all the questions vanished. No more questions. You see the pictures from TV, you know the numbers of people who died, and you don't ask any more questions, whether it's right or wrong, what we do. I was in Ramallah for 2-3 weeks. We just had the feeling that now we're protecting the country. Coming back with loads of weapons, of dozens of people that we arrest one after another. And because of the environment around it, we just stopped to ask questions. We stopped seeing things around you. We did a siege around one of the Palestinian police stations near Ramallah, and we were told by the Secret Service about all these wanted terrorists who are hiding there. And after 2, 3, or 4 days, I don't remember exactly, in these situations, kind of like, things get messed up in your head. They surrendered. There was a group of like 100 and something, just, you know, children and women from the families of people who were, you know, who served in that station. It doesn't matter what you see, you don't really ask questions. And after 3 weeks, instead of being sent to the Jenin refugee camp, thanks God, I was sent back to Hebron. We came back to Hebron and we're replacing the unit that was there for the past month when we were inside Ramallah. And that's when even it strengthened our belief and feeling that it's very important that people like us should be there. Because we started to hear stories about what the settlers did in the past month, breaking into 24 Palestinian shops and destroying everything. We heard stories about sometime that the police really arrested two settlers who broke into a Palestinian shop, and the soldiers in the post just opened the police car, cut the handcuffs, and released them. And you kind of hear these stories, and you even get... you believe stronger in this thing that it's very important people like us would be there, because we didn't allow the settlers to do this. And in the first week when I was back in Hebron, I was on patrol inside a sterile zone where Palestinians cannot enter. There was a big building of medical clinics, and the idea was that the patrol, if it walks around that area, you kind of climb up the building, up to the roof, and observe the streets, you know, for 20, 25 minutes, make sure that no wrong is going around. And we started climbing up the roof, towards the roof, reached the first floor, and suddenly I see that the door is open. Now, a month ago when we left there, you know, I was in the place for 5 months. I knew the place enough, good enough. All the doors were closed. So, you know, just out of curiosity, I pushed the door and entered what used to be a medical dentist clinic, a Palestinian dentist clinic. And I was totally shocked. I was terrified. The soldiers who replaced us just destroyed everything, shitted on the floor. Everything was broken, just like Dylan sang. The desk, mirrors, refrigerators, everything was broken. And two things happened to me then. The first is I took a camera that I had with me all the time and took pictures. First weekend leave I opened an email, soldierstalk@wala.com. Send out these pictures and a story to all every journalist that I could put together. No one replied to me. The second thing that happened is I decided that I'm going to be a commander. I'm going to be a commander because we don't act like that. And I need to educate soldiers that they won't act like that. And I came to my sergeant and told him, look, Nadav, I want to become a commander. He started laughing and told me, what are you, screwed up? You know, a month ago, people, you know, talking about refusal, now you want to be a commander? And I said, yeah, you were with me. You saw what happened there. It's important that we go and change this. So, leaving Hebron, getting around Nablus and other villages around the West Bank for a few days. And I found myself in sergeant course around June 2002. During the sergeant course, we were called to another operation in Bethlehem. And inside Bethlehem, you have a refugee camp called Daisha. And our mission was to impose curfew on the city and the refugee camp. Curfew means, just that you understand, curfew means you're not allowed to leave the house day and night. Usually when you have curfew, you open it for 2-3 hours once every 4 or 5 days. So people can get supply. We were driving with two APCs. APC is an armored personal carrier. It's like a tank without a cannon that you use to move on troops. One or two tanks, I don't remember exactly the numbers. And just patrolling and enforcing curfew on the city. The experience that I've had and things that I've seen in those 3 weeks, I can go on not for 50 minutes, I can go on for 9 years probably and talk about them. But what I've seen there brought me to a place of understanding that if I don't go back to my unit, I'm leaving the military, there is no way I continue to do this job. I'll just share something, 8-hour shift. and I hope I won't take too much time. We were driving with these APCs and tanks on the streets. Have you seen an APC before? I'll try to... An APC is like a box. Try to imagine that this is higher. The door is basically the back goes down and up goes down. You just go and close it up again. We were driving and there was a group of kids on the edge of the refugee camp. A group of kids, 10, 11, 12, 14, not more than that years old, were throwing stones at us. Now, the unit that I come from, you don't do nothing. You just continue on because curfew is imposed. No terrorists are on the street. You're inside an APC in a tank. You barely hear the stones that hit you because the noise of the engine. But my officer decided that, you know, we're going to impose some order on this area. And we stopped all the vehicles, got out, starting chasing them. Usual game when you serve in the territories. You start chasing the kids, throwing stun grenades, tear gas grenades, shooting some rubber bullets. After 10 minutes, we kind of got, you know, cat the enemy. It was around a 12-year-old boy, handcuffed, blindfolded him, taking him back to the APC. And I was the last in the patrol, kind of the last guy in the patrol, checking that no one is attacking us from the back. And I arrived last to the APC. The door is open. The kid is on the door, on the floor, basically. My squad is like half a circle around him. And I just, you know, I just arrive and I catch something like, one of the soldiers tells him, the kid in Hebrew, something like, don't you think you have to mature and grow up? People your age are already blowing up buses. What are you doing still throwing stones on me? And everybody started laughing. And I just approached and said, hey, guys, what is the carnival here? What's going on? And immediately everybody started, shut up, leftists, go distribute candies and checkpoints and the usual stuff that you say in the military you're probably not familiar with. So I'll try to not get into it. And my sergeant is the guy who's supposed to teach me how to be a good sergeant in the military, tells me something like, Yuda, don't you think that, don't you understand that if you don't treat him this way, he will grow up and become a suicide bomber? And I was just, oh, stupid prick, it's just exactly the opposite, but I'm shutting up because I want to graduate a sergeant course. And, you know, we dump him in the corner, enter, and start going on. Continue driving an hour or 2 hours around. I see our radio guy who's in charge of shooting rubber bullets. I'll just explain for a minute what a rubber bullet is. It's a piece of steel, of metal, that is surrounded by rubber. It's not sharp. It's flat on both sides. Usually it comes three or four rubber bullets together in a nylon. Now, if you shoot them together, they're not lethal. Because they spread out, you can't really aim them, and you use X amount of energy to fire four bullets. But if you separate them, they can become lethal just like live ammunition in close distance. And I'm sitting in the APC, and I see one of my, the guy, the radio guy who was in charge on shooting rubber bullets is separating them. And that was already too much, although I was, you know, got yelled at before. I started yelling at him, tore his pouch with all the rubber bullets that he separated, and everybody again was starting, shut up lefties, go distribute candies and checkpoints. And after an hour, we finished our shift, we got back to the barracks, and the sergeant of the other platoon that was patrolling the other side of the refugee camp just killed a Palestinian kid, youth, 16-year-old, with a rubber bullet to his chin. There was no investigation. No one really questioned anything. That was just, you know, a few highlights from an in-hour shift. And that was enough for me to understand that I want to go back to my unit. And I came back to my unit. I was a commander on the Lebanon border in north of Israel. And very fast, I find my way to become a company sergeant, which is more dealing with logistics. Today, I analyze it because I couldn't continue to do politically what was an operational job demanded for me. Came back to Hebron, and basically I finished my service as a company sergeant. Now, throughout all my service, or throughout my, basically since I was 11th grade, in 11th grade, the script to my life was written down. I knew what I'm going to do. I'm thinking graduate high school, join the military, finish military service, travel to Canada, work for my cousin, earn some money in dollars, travel to India, get stoned a bit. Forgive me for not being so educational here. Leave things behind, come back to Jerusalem, SATs, Jewish philosophy, Hebrew University. That was my, still it's my dream. I don't know if I will fulfill it one day. And it was around 3-4 months before I finished my service, and I'm kind of sitting down with myself outside of Bethlehem, company sergeant, nothing really important to do, a lot of spare time, starting to, you know, think about life. And just sitting down and with myself, I'm thinking, you know, who am I? And what society do I want to live in? What do I want to do in my life? For me, it was, you can call it an enlightenment moment, this second of just start thinking about life. It was the first second that, you know, I stopped being a combat soldier who thinks with combat soldier's logic and started becoming a civilian who thinks with a very different logic, with a different, very different point of view. It's like, you know, you change your disc and mind. And the first minute I did it was a very terrifying moment for me, because I don't know if you paid attention, but until now I spoke about a lot of things that other people around me did and nothing about myself. Because that's the way I saw things when I was inside the military. You know, it was about, okay, oh, you stand in Hebron and settlers are, you know, they're terrible, but we're the good guys. And then you go and meet other units. Oh, they do terrible stuff, but we're the good guys. And suddenly when you kind of, you know, you leave behind the military logic and you start to think, you start to observe things from outside, the first minute I didn't want to believe that it was me. You know, you want to believe, you want to think that the uniform, the helmet, the rifle were walking alone on the roads and in the streets and doing what was done. And I think the most important thing I realized, it was very fast, that in 3-4 months from now, when I was sitting down, I'm going to give back my weapon, I'm going to get back my uniform, I'm going to become a civilian, but I can't give back myself, what I did, who I became because of that. And that was when I understood that I can't continue my life without doing something about it. I had no idea what is going to be this something. But I started talking with my comrades, and I discovered that we all felt the same. Somewhere in the back of our mind, we all felt that things are wrong. I don't know if it was we didn't have the courage to speak about it, or we couldn't put it into words, we didn't understand it. And basically, this is how Breaking the Silence came. We were a group of people talking about our experience. It was obvious that we're going to do something. It was obvious that it's going to be about Hebron, not because Hebron is the worst place we served in, just because out of my service, I was 1 year and 2 months in Hebron. And we opened our photo albums and understood that just snap pictures we took documenting our ordinary life tell a story that anyone who wasn't with us there has no clue about. Suddenly you discover that people back home have no idea of what was going on. Suddenly you discover that there is a silence around what's going on. I finished the military in my military service in March 2004, and in June 2004 we opened an exhibit inside Israel in Tel Aviv. We were a group of 65 soldiers putting our photographs and video testimonies in the gallery, screaming out, not really understanding what we want to say, not really having an idea of what's going around, just having this strong sense of feeling that something is wrong and we can fill in. If we will just stand up and say the story. And June 1st, we opened the exhibit, and very fast we found ourselves in the middle of a huge mess. For 3-4 days, all what the Israeli media was dealing with was soldier testimonies from Hebron. We didn't understand what's going around us. We were invited to present the exhibit in the Israeli parliament and the Knesset for the next month. Over 7,000 people came to visit the exhibit. We were there from morning to night, taking people around and guided tours, telling our personal story. We were just people who knew how to operate machine guns, not how to send out a press release. And suddenly we found ourselves in the middle of, you know, inside of all this. The most important thing, I think, that happened to us throughout that month was that if the exhibit was 65 people from my battalion who served in Hebron, suddenly we realized that the story is way bigger. Out of these thousands of people who came to the gallery, a few dozens were just like us, young Israelis, veterans, who just finished military service, who served in different areas and different units, and suddenly they came in and, you know, and started speaking. And, you know, one after one after one after one till the coin drops and you understand that you just, you know, with this very personal act, we just opened this Pandora box of bringing people to speak about what's going on there. We had a meeting and we decided that we're going to continue on with our work. And I'll just say two, three words about our aim and open it to questions because I understand we don't have enough time. Our work basically since then is two main things that we do. The first project, what we consider to be the heart of our project, is, as our name says, Breaking the Silence, documenting soldiers' testimonies in video and audio. Until today, we've interviewed over 570 people, all people who served as conscript, meaning that they're draft, throughout the Second Intifada, so everyone is more or less my age, 21 to 28, 9. And these testimonies we publish in our website, some of the booklets I brought here, but there's definitely not enough booklets here, so feel free to log on to our website, breakingthesilence.org.il, and all the booklets that were translated to English, which are 4 out of 7, you can download in a PDF format. And basically, these testimonies and the stories are the base to our educational work, being it lectures, presentations, coming to talk about how our own story. Every year we hold around 80 to 100 lectures, mainly, vast majority of them, in front of Israeli high school students, trying to confront them with a different narrative of what's going on in the territories. And we do guided tours to the West Bank, basically to Hebron and South Mount Hebron, just that you get the numbers. In 2007, we've taken 150 tours to Hebron, a bit more than 3,000 participants. And out of these 3,000, 700 were young Israelis before draft. So again, this is the most important audience for us. We do what we do. If you try to summarize the idea behind Breaking the Silence into a few sentences, so for us the story is to try to confront the Israeli society with a mirror of its own. For us the story is to try to force a moral debate inside Israel regarding the moral price tag of occupation. In a way, Breaking the Silence is all about telling the reality behind the headlines in the news. Telling those small stories who make the big conflict, who make the big story. Telling the story of the occupation through an eye of a soldier, of an occupier, and raising up the question that we feel is the most important question to ask in a democratic society, and that is, what is our red lines? What is our moral boundaries as a society? To which extent we stand behind our military, and when we say no, not in our name. And that's what Breaking the Silence is all about. We're not here to solve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, not even close to that. We're not here to promote any political solution, not even close to that. In a way, we're here to create more problems. And we're here to speak the truth. I hope it's a bit clear for now what we do and who we are. And I know how it goes from here.
Thank you so much, Yehuda, for sharing with us. If anyone has questions, would you come down to the front so that you can speak your question into the microphone? I know this was it's been very, very interesting for people, and I'm sure there are things in your mind, but it's just phrasing a question, isn't it? Here is our first one, Yehuda, if you're if you're ready to respond.
Shalom Yehuda, gam ani hayiti nachlai. I served in the West Bank 20 odd years ago. Some of the things you said rang a bell with me. How much damage do you think the occupation has done? How much damage do you think the occupation has done to Israel over the last 40 years?
Maybe I'll try to answer you with a testimony of one of my soldiers. His name is Ben. I admire this guy. He's an amazing person. And the text that I'm reading now, his testimony was given while he was in service. He understood things that took me a few months out to get outside of the military to understand. I was ashamed of myself the day that I realized that I simply enjoyed a feeling of power. I don't believe in it. I think this is not the way to do anything to anyone. Surely not to someone who has done nothing to you. But you can't help but enjoy it. People do what you tell them. You know it's because you carry a weapon. Knowing that if you didn't have it, and if your fellow soldiers weren't beside you, they would jump on you, beat the shit out of you, and stab you to death. You begin to enjoy it. Not merely enjoy it, you need it. And then when someone suddenly says no to you, what do you mean no? Where do you draw the chutzpah from to say no to me? Forget for a moment that I actually feel that all these Jews are mad and he's talking about the settlers in Hebron. And I actually want peace and believe we should leave the territories. How dare you say no to me? I am the law. I am the law here. And then you sort of begin to understand that it makes you feel good. I remember a very specific situation. I was at a checkpoint, a temporary one, a so-called strangulation checkpoint. It was a very small checkpoint, very intimate, four soldiers, no commanding officers, no protection worthy of a name, a true moonlighting job, blocking the entrance to a village. From one side, a line of cars wanting to get out, and from the other side, a line of cars wanting to pass. A huge line. And suddenly you have a mighty force at the tip of your fingers, as if playing a computer game. I stand there like this, pointing at someone, gesturing to you to do this or that, and you do this or that. The car starts, moves towards me, halts beside me, the next car follows, you signal, it stops. You start playing with them like a computer game. You come here, you go there, like this, you barely move. You make them obey the tip of your fingers. It's a mighty feeling. It's something you don't experience elsewhere. You know it's because you have a weapon. You know it's because you are a soldier. You know all this, but it's addictive. When I realized this, I checked in with myself to see what had happened to me. That's it. And it was a big bubble that burst. I thought I was immune. That is, how come someone like me, a thinking, articulate, ethical, moral man, things I can attest to about myself without needing anyone else to validate for me. I thought of myself as such, suddenly I noticed that I'm getting addicted to controlling people. I'll take another a minute to complete this answer, sorry for him, just to put it in a context. 2-3 days after we open our exhibit, the military send the deputy brigadier general of the brigade that I served in with TV cameras to kind of give answers to his ex-soldiers. And he came and we had a discussion, he visited a gallery and we had a discussion and he said, after 20 minutes, he said, you know what guys, I totally agree what you're doing and what you're saying. There is one thing we disagree on, and that is, look, what you describe here, you call it moral corruption, you call it numbness, losing sensitivity, I call it growing up. It took us a minute to understand what he's saying. Yona, my friend who was a sergeant with me, stood up and told him, you know what, you're totally right, this is why we're doing what we're doing. Because this is growing up in Israel for the past 40 years. I'm saying this, but it's very important for me to say that I don't consider myself as a victim. I'm a victim of being a victimizer, but I'm not a victim. I'm not the victim. And that's important to state. is to understand that, yes, we're paying a personal price, but if I murdered someone, I can't fall asleep, but he's dead. So both things.
Thank you. What you just said and read out partially answers my question, but my question is, how did you manage to pass as a soldier with the feelings that you had and the reactions that you made against the status quo?
I don't know. I have no idea how. I just know I did it. And that's a proof that you can. When you're inside the military, there are things that are very, very powerful than anything you can imagine. The brotherhood, the mindset of military. I'll give you an example. I said that I broke my own silence and I understood what I did, but I didn't give an example to that. So let me give an example to that. One of the things that constantly we did in Hebron was what we called in the military making our presence felt. Military logic says that if the Palestinians will feel that the IDF is all the time everywhere, they'll be afraid to attack. So basically you take the battlefield into their place and you make your presence felt. What does it mean to make your presence felt? You go on your night shift patrol from 8 o'clock, from 10 o'clock at night to 6 o'clock in the morning. You start your shift bumping into one house, one Palestinian house in the old city of Hebron. I'm not talking about a house where you get intelligence about a suspicious terrorist and you come to arrest him. I'm talking about, as a sergeant, I pick a house, randomly house, nothing to do with any intelligence before that I know. You bump into the house, wake up the family, men there, women there, search the place, get out, shoot some bullets through the air, throw some stun grenades, light some fires, knock on some doors, run to the other corner of the old city, invade another house, and this is how you would pass your 8-hour shift. Now, back then it made sense because we called it making our presence felt. It has a logic. It has a military logic. Things looked right.
Sir, I respect you as a former soldier. I would like to ask whether you have suffered retribution by implication or in practice from your state?
Until now, no. Not individually. There was an attempt to try to silence us in June 2004 with military police investigators bumping in and confiscating some stuff, and we were called to interrogations. But no. After all, I'm an Israeli Jew, and within its borders, Israel is still quite open and democracy.
A few months ago, some friends of mine and myself heard from a member of another organization where Israeli and Palestinian combatants talk together about their experiences. Have your experiences caused you to empathize with Palestinian combatants? And if so, where has that empathy taken you?
I hope I understand right the question. It's not a matter of empathy to Palestinian combatants, or I don't know. I live in the world of politics. This is where I try to think and act. And I would say something, and I hope you understand me right, because it's very difficult for me. English is not my first language. But in general, the Palestinian society for me is a political issue. The Israeli society for me is an existential issue. Because I'm an Israeli. While the situation remains as it is today, I live in Israel and I feel that the position that I'm taking as breaking the silence is not something that as yet need to be brought into Palestinian side. So I'm kind of trying for political... I just think it's wrong. You know, in South Africa, when you had the Truth and Reconciliation Committees, it was just after apartheid ended, not before. It's kind of like... So while I'm thinking as breaking the silence, I'm trying to stay away and not to try to force the reality as I see it and the actions that I do on the other side.
Okay, two more questions.
How has your experience, which you have described to us, impacted on your faith as an ultra-Orthodox Jew?
Okay, it had to come. It's a faith gathering, you know. That was stupid. I thought it wouldn't come. Look, it's quite complicated, but... And probably most of the people there, I hope you won't beat me up for this. But I don't know. I don't see any connection between my religious values and morality. I see myself as a professional schizophren, an Orthodox Jew who lives in a modern secular world, which, you know, he has to hold both sets of values in parallel, kind of a humanistic secular sets of values in parallel to an Orthodox Jewish set of values. And everybody, you know, and every time just needs to, you know, work with both. I must say that might be the reason that I like so much Hebron, kind of an affair I have with that city, is because what's going on in Hebron specifically manages to unite my both identities. Because what's being done in Hebron is not only being done with my secular identity, the flag of the state that I'm a citizen of, it's also in the name of my God. And in a way, I think, almost the only place where I kind of feel that both sides of my identity coming together are coming together and for the same reason, the same cause. I hope I made sense with what I said.
And after this last question and its response, Garth will close for us.
Thanks. I wondered if you could give us some kind of insight into the mindset of Israeli politics, because on the one hand, it seems to be almost the most open democracy on earth, and there's a huge left-right spectrum, and you would expect in such a spectrum for there to be some sympathy at least towards breaking the silence. And I wonder if you could tell us whether at the political level there is.
I'm not a guy who believes in politics in that sense. I think politicians are more cynical than me. So inside Israeli political world, as politicians... Nothing is really serious being done from either side, in a way. But I just want to say that when we talk about the society, there is one thing that for me is very important to say. We're standing here and we talk about silence. The most important thing is to understand that silence is not an Israeli sickness. Silence is a human disease. When your face looks terrible, you don't want to stand in front of a mirror. When you're doing bad things, you don't want to know. So it's not about being an Israeli or being a non-Israeli or being a Jew, a Christian, a Muslim. It's just being a human being who is involved in things that are disgusting, and you just make everything not to bring, you know. You won't come back home on Friday night and say, "Hey, Mommy, these are two Palestinians we killed last night. Isn't it cool?" You know, no one wants to hear that. Mommy doesn't want to know this. You don't want to know her. You know, you don't want her to know that. It's kind of this code of silence, you know, this agreement of, we know there is some shit going back there, but please don't bring it back home. And my mother is just like all other mothers in the world. There's no chance that you that did this, no? I know him since he doesn't do these things, right? It's always very, very easy to look through a window on someone else than to take a dark color, paint one of the sides, and confront a mirror. And if there is something we can take out from here, I think it's that. So, just like all societies are involved in silence, my society is also involved. And if it's all about taking responsibility, so my responsibility is to break our silence. And if it's all about taking responsibility, you kind of understand that responsibility doesn't start and ends with being a combat soldier who speaks out. It doesn't start and end with being an Israeli citizen. It doesn't start and end with being a Jew. It starts and ends with being a human being.
There are a few leaflets and DVDs around the place. So where were the ones you put, Tim? They're over by the door. There's a few DVDs here as well that Yehuda has brought. And just as I think you've shown your appreciation, that when we were interviewing Yehuda in the summer, one of the questions I kept getting him to answer, and he wriggled, he didn't want to answer, was about hope. And I remember then he said, no, I don't have hope about the situation. But he then said, made a quote about getting up in the morning and doing the right thing. And in terms of what we have heard today, this is where I find hope, where someone says, where are the moral red lines? And let's break the silence. And perhaps we can just show once again our appreciation for Yehuda. Thank you.